few years ago, I was sitting with my mom. She was at the summit. And we were having a good time laughing, talking about times when I was a little boy. Lots of funny times. And she said to me, "Oh, Bryant, you were a good boy." But then she paused. And she asked, "You were a good boy, weren't you?" So I had to pause and think, well, how do I answer this? And I said, "Mom, yeah, I was a good boy, but it wasn't easy. Started good, as I was told the day I was born, a very sunny day in December, and my mother was in labor, and it was taking a while, so her and my dad actually went out for a walk outside the hospital, and I was born later that afternoon. That might have been the high point. To begin with, I got hurt a lot, and I just thought I was a normal, active boy. But I'd come to my mom, leaning from my head, holding my broken wrist, and she'd say, "Oh, Bryant." And it was almost routine. A lot of times she'd be cooking, turns off the burners, shuts everything down, into the car, out to see Dr. Sam in West Seattle. And unfortunately, this happened more than once. Eyeglasses. When I was in second grade, I think it was second grade, they sent me home with a note, "I need to get my eyes checked." Okay. So back then, you had to drive all the way downtown. And so Mom took me downtown, had my eyes checked, and the doctor said, "Yeah, we think Bryant needs glasses." And my mom said, "Are you sure?" And the doctor says, "Well, Mrs. Clitterman, does Bryant like to play baseball?" And she said, "Oh, yeah." And then he said, "Well, would you like him to be able to see the baseball?" And she laughed. And so that was the start of glasses. Now, back then, frames were these heavy plastic frames. You'd think they'd be indestructible. But normal, active boy, I was constantly bending or breaking these glasses, and of course, was always going downtown to get it fixed. After a while, my mom stopped taking me. She said, "You go to school, I'll take care of this." I said, "Well, but Mom, I need to be there because they got to fit me." "They'll be okay." "But Mom, I can't see." "You go and listen." Okay. And sure enough, Dunlap Elementary School, and they would deliver me my glasses. One day my glasses were delivered, and I had PE that day. And when they built Dunlap Elementary School, I'm sure building codes were quite a bit different, because it was a nice wood court, two baskets, lined, but then you had about 3 feet from the boundary, and then a cement wall. And I have the vivid memory of the moment. I don't even remember the game, but I'm diving for the ball. I had to walk home that day, and when I saw Mom, all I could sure. "Oh, Bryant." Now, this is one of her best moves. One time when I was young, I got sick from eating too many hot dogs. And after that, I couldn't eat hot dogs. Well, you know, sometimes hot dogs is on the menu. Now, my mom's already putting two dinners out every night, one for us, and then another for my dad when he got home from work at about 8:30 or 9. So she wasn't about to cook me something special. So one of the days hot dogs was coming up, and I said, "But Mom, I can't eat hot dogs." And she was serious. She says, "I know, Brian. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I won't get hot dogs. I'll get Franks." And I said, "Franks?" Yeah, Franks. Okay. And sort of as a side note, my mom laughed a lot, but sometimes at the wrong time. Like I'd be getting in trouble, and not on purpose, but I'd say or do something, she'd start laughing. And if I saw her laugh, it was over. She's like, "Oh, you're laughing. What I did wasn't that bad." And she knew that I had a point. So she got really good at not letting me see her laugh. So I'm sure when I reminded her, "Now remember, Mom, get Franks." "Yes, Bryant." She'd turn around, go to the garage. She had to be cracking up. Now, the teen years weren't so cute. But karma paid me back on that. I mean, I love you, Shayla. But we don't need to talk about that. But early in my teaching career, as a teacher, you see everything. You see what's really out there. And so talking to her on the phone once, I did have the opportunity to say, "Mom, you sure did a good job raising me." And she did.
Thank you, Brian. I'd like to call on one of the grandchildren, Jennifer.
Pastor Clinton, I'm sure that I never called her that. She was my bubby. She was my bubs. She loved when I called her that. She loved when all of her grandchildren called her that. As her first grandchild, and I'm pretty sure her favorite, I would introduce myself to her as she got older. "Jennifer, your favorite granddaughter." Oh, yes. And so I believe that she knows that. For the last couple of days, I've been thinking of memories with her and what she means to me and what I'm going to say, and I've been drawing blanks. And we have 37 years of granddaughter lady, which is so special and so different from any other relationship. It's not a mother, it's not a sister. It is that woman who spoils you, who is always there for you, who doesn't let you get away with shit, and especially my bubby. She was a tough little cookie, and she was hilarious about it. Some of my favorite memories are from when I was a little girl, and I would spend the night at her house. We'd go over often. It was a vacation for me, and I'm sure it was a vacation for my parents as well. And I remember that she would paint my teeny tiny little grubby girl hands. And I loved it. And thinking about it now, it just seems like torture. Like, I know I wasn't standing still. I remember the nail polish would get on the side of my hands, and I would get so mad at Bobby for not keeping it on my nails. But I was just moving them all around. We baked a lot. She was an amazing cook. I mean, her Boyus were unparalleled to anyone's. I don't think anyone will dispute that fact. I remember being little. I don't know how old I was, but we were making mazapan and from almonds. And I remember my job was to peel the almond skins off the almonds. And it sounds like, okay, that's not a bad job. And so I get this massive bowl of almonds, and I'm like, "Bubby, I don't know what to do here. Like, it's not coming off. I'm using my little baby fingernails trying to rip them off." And Then she's like, no, we have to soak them in water. So these almonds are soaking in water. Maybe we're playing a game while they're getting soft, and I'm peeling off. It's the worst job there is. That's why she gave it to me. No one wants to peel almond skins. But I loved working with her in her kitchen and making the mazapan, and I got to cut them into the diamond, that shape that we all know, with that little perfect silver dot of some sort of something in there. I couldn't put them on straight, so I got taken off of that job, but I ate them really well. She also made amazing bread, and her panuzikus, I remember, were the best. That's beautiful, delicious, sweet rolls, and I would go, they're out for all the holidays, and probably every day in her freezer. As Jewish grandmothers have freezers full of food for all days. I don't know where it comes from. I can't keep anything in my freezer. And I would go around and I would pick out all the sweet bread on the inside, and I would leave the crust on the outside. And she would get so mad at me. And then I learned, instead of taking a whole roll and putting it in front of me, I would just take out the inside and I would just put it back on the pile. And I didn't get caught for a while, but then when I did, it wasn't the best. But she got over it because, again, I was her favorite granddaughter. Every year she would take us shopping for our birthday, me and my sister, and I'm sure my cousins when they were in town. It was her tradition. It was what we did. We looked forward to it every year. We went to South Center. I think I only went to South Center with my bubby pretty much. We'd go shopping, we'd go out to lunch, and we'd get a new outfit, and it was such a special time. I don't remember when we stopped doing that. As you become a teenager, you stop wanting to hang out with your grandparents for some reason. But I already know when I moved back to Seattle and I was visiting with her, I said, Bubby, can we start going shopping again for my birthday, and you can buy me an outfit and take me out to lunch? And it's more expensive taste now, so I think it will be a great time for us to restart that. And naturally she said, of course, my darling, of course. And she said, but this time I think you need to take me shopping. You need to get me some clothes. She always needed to get some new clothes. So we did. But we didn't quite make it to the department stores. I remember when I got to her house at the Summit, she needed to go grocery shopping. So I'm not sure what we needed. I think she might have been out of Werther's Originals. She loved those Werther's Originals, and maybe she only had like two or three flavors of ice cream in her freezer. She needed about 4 to 5. She liked her sweets, but she was also very aware of her cholesterol, because I remember she would make hard-boiled eggs. Every time I would go over, there would be hard-boiled eggs boiling on the stove on the lowest heat ever. It takes me like 14 minutes. It took her about an hour and 14 minutes to make hard-boiled eggs. But she would take out the yolk on both of them and cut half of them and then put it back in, because she was, you know, like this big, and she came up to my hips, and she was watching her cholesterol. She was so cute. But she was always laughing and making jokes and so proud of her family and her brothers and her sons. And like my Uncle Bryant kind of talked about, the stories that she would tell all the holidays. We would get together at her house and sit in her dining room and tell the same stories over and over again. That Frank story, I've heard that a lot. Maybe for some of you guys, there's another great story that she likes to tell with my uncles with her brothers and my uncles, and taking Uncle Norm out for ice cream in that knit white suit and just dropping him off at the door covered in chocolate ice cream. We heard that one a lot too. I could go into the details, but it just wouldn't be as good. So I won't. Bubby, she was such a beautiful person, because she never, I don't want to say she never pressured us to do anything, because she is a grandma and we disagreed on some things. But the main thing about her is that she would say, if you are happy, I am happy. And that stays with you, and that stuck with me. And she was always supportive and just wanted to have a good time and spend time with her family and see us and see us more. And the last thing that she said to me, I saw her a couple weeks ago at the Klein, and I went down with my sister to go talk to her. She wasn't really talking, and I didn't really know if she knew I was there. And so I was telling her stories about my day and just filling her in on what was going on, and she didn't say much. And then when it was time for us to leave, I said, "Bubby, I love you so much. I'll see you soon. Is that okay that we're going to go?" I felt horrible leaving her. And she turned to me and my sister, and she said, "Well, I certainly hope so." And I was like, "There you are. There's that little spitfire, that little personality and attitude just coming right back out." And then she blew us a kiss, and it was like, you know, and I know, and I love her. And thank you all for coming and listening to me tell my stories.
So I'm probably not going to tell you many things you don't already know about this wonderful woman whom we've come to pay a lasting tribute, Esther Kligerman. But I will try to provide a perspective on her life that, although I encountered her many times at the summit, in the community, at different events, she was, for the record, I probably don't have to tell you this either, she was always very kind, sweet, gentle demeanor, a smile that was contagious, and nothing but kind. Esther Kligerman, if I'm doing the numbers correctly, she was born June 1st, 1926, so that would have made her almost 92 years old. She has three wonderful children, Alan, Bryant, Norman, and their extended families. She was married to her wonderful husband, Mike Kligerman, for almost, I think it was 47, 48 years before his passing, in 1999. She was a devoted wife, a devoted mother, and just an all-around good friend and good person to everybody that she had in her life. She had some great talents. She was an outstanding individual with numbers and accounting. She was an excellent baker, an excellent cook, and an excellent human being. But when sitting with the family yesterday, I learned some things that you don't know unless you have an opportunity in these unfortunate circumstances to sit down and find out some of the finer points of an already fine woman. The one thing that came right through speaking to the family yesterday, almost in unison, almost with music behind it, was her profound care that she provided to her mother, Vida Pija, blessed memory. She was the daughter of Samuel and Vida Pija. And they couldn't stop talking about it, how she was just a fabulous, they didn't even use the word caregiver, because although a caregiver is a nice phrase and a nice word, it also connotes that you're in a position of an official capacity. But she wasn't. She, as a dutiful daughter, she took care of her mother with all of her might. Extremely sensitive to all of her needs. And it also happens to be the fifth commandment. But I doubt very much if she consulted the five books of Moses before, although it is a commandment, before engaging in this act of loving kindness, both to the memory of her father and during the life of her mother, taking such good care of her. And it might sound trite, it might sound like it's a given, but if you look around, especially in the world today, parents aren't who they used to be to their children in the days of old. And that's not a good thing, but she maintained a tradition that is truly remarkable. They also told me of a story yesterday that was also indicative of an individual who has unbelievable qualities. Alan was telling me that at one point in her life, I think it was probably 15 or 20 years ago, she woke up one day and it was discovered by her that her vision was no longer what it was. Literally, and no pun intended whatsoever, this is a serious matter, with a blink of an eye, she lost a component of her vision. And on that very same day that she discovered that malady and that, in my opinion, that traumatic fact, vision we none of us takes for granted, on that very same day that she discovered it, she went with all of her friends, and they were absolutely clueless that that event had happened to her. She never let on to them. That is an unbelievably unselfish act of kindness. Do you know how great it is? Do you know how profound it is not to unload what is bothering you on an individual or a group of people who are so close to you? Probably not because she was ashamed of what happened to her, but she was so courteous and so unselfish and so giving, she did not want to burden them with what had happened to her. So she continued on, and this was her positive attitude. But it's more than just a positive attitude. It's caring about the people around you, because she knew if she had told them, it would elicit sympathy and empathy and probably sadness because they loved her. But she wouldn't go down that road. And that is a road few people travel, because the tendency is to, you know, misery and company are, they go hand in hand. You want company when things don't go right. But she was a rock in that way. I don't know if this kind of circulated around social media, maybe a couple of years ago, and I don't remember the individual who forwarded it to me, and I don't remember the name of the military officer who presented this, and it really went viral. He was an admiral in the Navy. He was a Navy SEAL. And I think he was giving an announcement, the commencement address at a college graduation. And he was talking about personal integrity, goodness in the world. One single individual, a human being, can change the world. He was telling how much he went through U.S. Navy SEAL training and how very difficult it was, and only the truly strong mentally and physically could endure. And he remembered one thing, and Esther's family told this to me yesterday unwittingly, that their mother always made them. I asked them, "What? Tell me something about growing up. What was life like growing up?" And again, almost in concert and in unison, they said, "You know what? Our mom always made us have chores in the house. And the one thing that they called out, Mom always made us make our bed. Every single day we had to make our bed." And this admiral, former U.S. Navy SEAL, said the same thing. He goes, "You must get in training camp, in boot camp, we had to make our bed every single day. What's this obsession with making beds?" I'll tell you what this obsession is with making beds. It's not the fact of making your bed to relieve your mother from a little extra work. Probably that's a dimple on a pimple of all of the work that she did. So I doubt very much she was trying to get out of work. But the notion of making your bed, it's the first thing that a Navy SEAL was trying to convey, that their officer in charge was making them do, because it provides order in your life. And if nothing else, and if you have a terrible day, heaven forbid, when you come back home, you will have a bed that is made. And if you have a wonderful day, you will know that the bed you made, as trivial as that sounds, will be the beginning of a success that will multiply throughout the rest of the day. And if you, this is unscientific, and I have no empirical data to back this up, but I bet if you did a poll of all of our mothers who told us to make our beds and we dreaded it and we did it, you know what? It impacts your life because it seems insignificant at the moment, but in the big picture of life, it reflects organization, structure, discipline, and what do you know, honoring your mother and father as well. So it seems small, it seems trivial, but it's huge. Esther was also very even-keeled. Again, you know how difficult that is to be even-keeled? Everybody goes through highs and lows. You get all excited in anticipation of something before you, be it a vacation, being a good thing that's coming down the pike, or if things just don't go your way, the peaks and valleys of life can really get you down. You don't know how to deal with it. I mean, the diet industry is making billions on people's mood swings because they've termed it something called comfort food. Well, you know what? Just tell me what food isn't comfort food. It's eating that is comforting. So it's masterful Madison Avenue marketing. So the trick is, how do you be even? How do you take the highs? And how do you manage the lows without swinging your life all over the board? We would have had to have asked Esther Kligerman how to do that because she was an expert at that. She knew how to manage life and remain positive and forge forward no matter what happened. She also had a tremendous faith in God. So much so that it came out yesterday when they were telling me, you know, if something didn't go right, if she received news that was less than welcome, or if they would ask her about the future, her answer would be, you know, everything's in the hands of God. And nowadays, in the 21st century, very few circles of people even acknowledge that there is a greater being in their life, God Almighty, who, in the Jewish tradition, obviously we believe with all of our heart and soul, that he is in charge of the world. And she uttered it. She articulated it. And that's why when we pray, you can't pray silently. You know, say if you go to synagogue, do I really need to say all of the words? Why can't I just read it like I'm reading a novel and call it a day? Why do we have to actually move our lips? Because you have to have the action. By saying it, you confirm it and you affirm it. And that's what she did throughout her life. She confirmed and she affirmed in the presence of her friends and family. You know what? Kligerman family, you know what? Piha family, just like my parents taught me, and just like how I was raised, there is a God and everything is in his hands. So manage our lives accordingly. We are not fully in charge. Then I asked, gathering yesterday with the family, what else do you remember about growing up in your home? You said they had a wonderful yet simple childhood, all of the pleasures of life that you could possibly ask for, raised by a devoted mother and father. Oh, but you know what? Friday night was always Friday night. It was Shabbat. My mother absolutely made us, or maybe not made us, but provided for us that on Friday night, dinner is always at home because of Shabbat, because of the Sabbath. Candles were lit, Kiddush was recited, and dinner was served. Again, you know what that is? That in Judaism is known as making your bed, because life does not begin until the values are transmitted to the children and to the family and to all of those around her. And that's what she did, and so much so that I didn't even try to elicit those kinds of comments from the family. It wasn't a religious meeting. It was just a meeting of, tell me more about your mother. I know her. I knew her. She was kind. She was generous. She had a smile. She was loving. She was a good person. But tell me what happened in the home. Tell me what was it like? And these were the highlights, meaning that they had a profound effect on Alan and Norman and Bryant and their extended families. We've all been to the summit, I presume. Or I shouldn't assume, many of us have been to the summit, and for some reason she is one of those individuals who I remember walking into the summit, not that she was the greeting committee, but I always see her in the life of the summit. She would be there, she'd always come over to me, we'd always greet each other happily and with a smile, and in order to do that, she had to have been outgoing. She had to have been someone not shy of other people. She was a friend to so many of the residents there, and she was part of many groups there that were very social, and she was a true friend to all of them. She will be sorely missed. I can say that, I'm sure, on behalf of the family, and especially given our discussions that we had yesterday. She was the loving sister of Victor and Maury, who we all remember of a blessed memory. And I see all gathered here today, so many friends and family of not only the children, but of the PHOP families that are just always so devoted to their own family structure and obviously an integral and pillars of our community, and I see the names on the list of her brothers who I remember well, and I didn't know her parents, but in Maury, her brother, in tribute to him, I'm sure he was a very good brother to her, and I'm sure Victor as well, but as a tribute to them, I feel like I do know Samuel and Vida Piha. Do you know how? Because every Yom Kippur, when Maury would be called to the Sefer Torah, or even other times during the year, I would see him coming up to the Teva as the Sefer Torah is open, and he would always make it a point to memorialize his parents. So much so that that's how I learned their names, that's how I learned who they were. And then as years go, and as years pass, and I see you all here, and as I met with the family yesterday, and as I knew Maury and I also knew Victor, but I knew Maury much, much better. And Esther, I feel like I had an inkling and a glimpse, a snapshot of who their parents were, even though I never met them. So to the families, and for all of us who have the privilege and pleasure of knowing Esther Klagerman of blessed memory, as we say, Hine Matov Umanaim, how beautifully pleasant that experience has been in life. She will be missed, and may her soul be bound up in the bond of life eternal. Amen.